Hi, I'm Rick Carter, production designer for Star Wars 9, The Rise of Skywalker, and you're listening to The Go Creative Show.
Hey, everyone. My name is Ben Consoli. I am a director, a producer, and owner of BC Media Productions. This is The Go Creative Show, the show dedicated to creative professionals and filmmakers. Today we speak with Rick Carter, the legendary production designer of films including Avatar, Jurassic Park, Back to the Future 2 and 3, and Star Wars Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker. The Go Creative Show is supported by Rule Boston Camera, Buy Rent Create at Rule, and PostLab, stress-free collaboration for Final Cut Pro. Well, we have a legend on Go Creative Show today, Rick Carter, production designer of basically every movie ever made. I mean, I'm looking at his work right now on IMDb. Look at this. Jurassic Park, Forrest Gump, Castaway, Avatar, Back to the Future 2 and 3, Star Wars Episode 7 and Star Wars Episode 9, and so much more. Like, it's mind-boggling, the portfolio that Rick Carter has. So you can only imagine the knowledge that is going to be shared today on this episode. And I cannot wait to bring it to you guys. You're going to notice that there's a couple of audience questions in here. And we've been doing this for the past few months. And I love it because you guys, the Go Creative Show audience, you guys are super smart. there's been a lot of questions that have come through and I'm like, damn, I wish I thought of that. I really do. So we're thankful that you guys have been asking these questions, and we're incorporating as many as we can into the show. And it's a great opportunity to have your voice heard, and we give you a little shout out, and it's been fun, and I know people have been liking it. So here's how you do it. You follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, and we let you guys know when we have upcoming guests and give you an opportunity to ask your questions. Then we take those questions, we ask them on the show, give you a little shout out, and everyone is happy. So please continue to do that if you are already following us on that on those platforms. And if you're not following us yet, why? Why, right? Come on, join us. It's fun. And don't forget to subscribe to us on your favorite podcast app, because that way you're not going to miss an episode. And why would you want to, with the type of guests that we've been serving up week after week? And another great one coming up right now. We've got Rick Carter, the production designer of basically everything, but especially Star Wars Episode 9, The Rise of Skywalker, right here on Go Creative Show. So I'm here with Rick Carter, production designer for Star Wars Episode 9, but so many other films. We are certainly going to get to that. It is amazing the work that you've done in your career, and I mean, still going strong. Like, this is, it's incredible when I look at your list of work. I mean, we're talking about certainly Star Wars, Avatar, Forrest Gump, Jurassic Park, Back to the Future 2 and 3. I mean, wow, what a get to have you here on Go Creative Show, and we're so thankful that you're here with us.
Thank you very much. When you pose the question or the broad canvas that you've laid out, which for me, of course, is my lifetime, or at least my career, and it's been about 45 years, I do recall it as a single trip, I mean, a journey of sorts. And that is the motif that I've always brought to my work and experienced in my work. And it's very personal because I started off in my adolescence, my late teens and early 20s, traveling around the world in the late 1960s and early 70s. And so when it came time to actually have a career, I really didn't know how I would apply any of that to something that I could do for the next 45 years. Mm. And it turns out that production design for me has been the perfect arena to work in. And it's primarily, I think, because there's a way that when you create the worlds for movies, there's a way to draw upon your own personal experiences of going to places. And if you have had experiences such as I have in my life, where I've had interesting experiences out into the world in various foreign places, and I could find a sense of place by being there, almost a spirit of place at times, and then try to invoke that when I was designing different worlds in various movies, so that I'm not only just doing it on a literal level of the script at hand, or the story, but I'm invoking sometimes places and feelings that I've had in my own life out on the road. So that's kind of an end to the discussion of a broad canvas of the last 45 years of traveling, not only in real life, but also in cinema. And so many of the movies I've done or been asked to work on, and I didn't pick them, they picked me, are journey movies, where you really go somewhere and then the drama unfolds as a result of going to a different place. It doesn't always happen in just a single setting. Sometimes there's a couple where it's been just a couple of settings and you go deeper and the journey is an interior type of experience. But for me, so many of the movies from Back to the Future and Jurassic Park and Forrest Gump and AI and Avatar and Star Wars movies and BFG and Lincoln, they really take you out into the world. So I guess I just start with that kind of a premise, and maybe that helps you to ask whatever you feel that you'd like to discuss.
Well, that's interesting. I was kind of curious about how much of your research process before you even start anything, how much of that is kind of sitting at your computer looking up, you know, the way things look in different areas of the world? Or are you at a position now where you can sort of demand as part of your budget the ability to go and travel places, take your own photos, sketch your own sketches, be in those environments and feel them? Like, what is your process in the very, very early pre-production?
Well, actually, in a strange way, it's both of those things. That on one hand, in reading the script and talking to the directors, I usually am very attuned to what's the metaphor that they are invoking in their story and the personal reasons that they're telling the story. So because I've worked for 20 years, the first 20 years was just with Steven Spielberg and Bob Zemeckis. So I got to know them quite well. And the dialogue that we would have as to why we were telling the story was very personal to them. So first of all, I could get to a personal level and an emotion that they were trying to convey through the story that they were telling. The second part is that there are budgets enough for me to be the person who not only goes on the computer now and researches and does my own sketches, along with, of course, illustrators making them look much better than mine do, but also to go out into the world. And it's almost like I feel at times I'm auditioning locations to be in a movie and trying to be as economical as I can and strategic so that we can make the movie not only for the price, but also in an efficient way. And that takes me to many places sometimes on movies, especially something like Munich, where it was all practically locations. But then to try to simplify the vision of what that series of locations were into maybe two or three hubs where we could still get everything that we were trying to do, but then invoke places that I had visited or that were historically correct that because of the research that I was able to do.
So I feel like, you know, you get a lot from the experience of being at these places. Like that, you sort of, I actually saw in one of the interviews that I looked at sort of prepping for this, is that for Avatar, you were inspired by the ocean. And you seem to get inspiration from things that people may not necessarily connect with the movie so much. So my question is, and what I'm most curious about is, when you first get a script, what is the first step to creating this new world? Like, are there questions that you ask a director every time? Are there things about the script that you look for and pull out? What is that early inspiration?
I think the first step is to read the script or hear the ideas, because sometimes there hasn't been a script when I've started.
Oh, so you're that early on sometimes?
Sometimes, yeah. But when we were doing For instance, well, even the Star Wars, The Force Awakens, or the latest one, I was on as the script was being developed, as the story was being developed. And then I'm asked to bring a visual point of reference to what is being discussed, but it's beyond just illustrating the ideas that are coming up or coming out of the writer and the director. It's more that many times the visual is the idea. So for instance, if you think about The Force Awakens and you ask yourself the question, and this doesn't quite get to the overall, except for I would just say, I let it wash over me, whatever the idea or whatever the script is, and don't try to pick it apart as much as try to feel it. So in The Force Awakens, one of the questions that I was asking when I first started on the Star Wars project, even before JJ was there, was how strong is the Force? What's the purpose of telling these Star Wars movies now? And so I actually asked a group of illustrators who I called visualists up at Lucasfilm, how strong is the Force? And you can't just answer that with words. You have to show it. You have to actually depict, like, where can this all go? Now, we came to a specific place where I asked a question of a group of people, and this is kind of, I guess, the way I do it in the collaborative way, is I don't have just my own interior process. I have a collaborative process that I often try to guide and be also receiving of people's ideas in a very collaborative way. So I asked a group of people, what would actually scare you about the return of the dark side? Like, what could they do that would actually be truly threatening? And it was Dennis Muren, the visual effects guru, who was in the meeting, who said, well, if the dark side could take the light out of a star, then that would be very, very powerful, because there it's Star Wars and taking the light out of the sky. And then JJ really liked that idea, and he sort of weaponized that so that that became the threat that is in the movie. So that is the whole underlying threat that the dark side is going to enact in the movie. And that's the kind of thing, or in this latest Star Wars movie, I was looking at the Star Destroyer, and there's some illustrations we were doing. And I just thought, wouldn't it be great to stage some kind of a swashbuckling, even like a Western scene on top of a Star Destroyer? Because it's always been thought of in Star Wars language from the beginning that it was Western in space. So that's what led to, for instance, the cavalry charge coming to the rescue and at the end of the movie. That kind of thinking, now those are action sequences. Sometimes it's more essential or basic level, such as in Forrest Gump, realizing the importance of that home and how the home that he lived in, that boarding house, would never change, even though he would travel out and have all these experiences. But the home that was represented, it's like the idea that Dorothy goes on her journey, but she goes back to Kansas now and again throughout her journey, and touches that base as it changes very little, other than that's where he experiences the loss of his, you know, his mother and his girlfriend and wife, Jenny. Mm. That's a kind of an emotional metaphor that I could tap into and understand that was at the heart of Forrest Gump, and that as a character, Forrest is not supposed to be a smart person. We even show you a little graph as though it was made for him by the principal to show you how dumb he is, or he doesn't quite make it. And yet he never does anything stupid in the whole movie. He's always following his heart. So it's kind of a MacGuffin that's at the center of the movie that is not actually true, meaning he isn't actually stupid. He even says, you know, I may not be a smart man, but I know what love is. And he always is following that. So then that type of feeling can lead to the type of decision-making where we wrapped a lot of scenes that were supposed to be out in the town and various other places into that oak alley that led to the house. And then even just building the house right where we did, with the tree framing it for me, it was a way to invoke Tara in that was in Gone with the Wind, because that's the framing of that old Southern story, which has many similarities, where it's a Southern story, the United States, and the world is sort of torn apart by a civil war, which is, in a sense, what was happening in the late 60s, early 70s to America. And that was a movie that we were creating, in a sense, I think Bob felt this, to try to be healing from those divisions that had occurred. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. Do you look for those kind of locations or sets in all of your films, like those places that we can keep going back to throughout the film that may have, you know, a different meaning for the cast or even the audience as the story progresses?
If the story allows for the person to go back, now sometimes it doesn't. For instance, although ultimately it does at the end, the movie AI, Artificial Intelligence,
yeah.
Once he is thrown out of his home, then he goes to a series of places. Those were all laid out by Stanley Kubrick. Now, he does return home at the end. And as you notice, that's in his imagination to be with his mother and to experience her love for him. All of these stories, if you can kind of imagine, same thing with Back to the Future 2, even Jurassic Park, and certainly Avatar and BFG, they're very much like The Wizard of Oz. And so the structure of the journey motif is something I experienced in real life as a young man, then also had a structure of the journey motif from the movies and the reading I've done in my life. That allows me an insight sometimes to these movies where, for instance, on Avatar, I saw that as The Wizard of Oz meets Apocalypse Now. Those are both journey movies. It sounds crazy, but it actually isn't. And I laid that out in a whole room that Jim came in and could see the thoughts I had about not only the progression of his movie, but the various levels that the movie goes to, that in some ways they are like The Wizard of Oz, in some ways even beyond, so that there is a Kansas in that movie, which is the Hell's Gate base on Pandora where the humans live. And in fact, even in the initial script, and it's in the extended DVD, there's scenes on Earth. But that's a human environment. Then once he takes the Avatar state, he actually goes out into the world of Pandora. But he comes back and forth. And so he not only has his human existence as Jake Sully, who is a twin, but he has a singular existence, as the Avatar who goes out into Home Tree and then the Well of Souls. And that kind of an experience of journeying out from a home base is very similar to The Wizard of Oz, but it even goes to another dimension, which is the bioluminescent dimension, which Jim described as phantasmagoric, which even in a sense goes beyond Oz. It's into a dream state. That's what phantasmagoric means. And that's what he had experienced at the bottom of the ocean when he was doing the Titanic movies, deep diving as he does in real life. He saw forms of life, the bioluminescent forms of life at the bottom of the ocean. And he brought back that as the idea that he wanted to convey about what the world really is naturally and how connected everything is, even on a consciousness level. Does that make sense?
What I got out of that bioluminescent sort of feel is almost like, you know, the humans, us on Earth, we always try to kind of create these sort of lit environments, these like New York City, places like, you know, Hong Kong, Tokyo, big cities that are intriguing and interesting and draw you in through their sort of lightscapes. But naturally these things happen too. And I think that's what's so interesting about that bioluminescent sort of feel. Am I going down the right road? Was there something like that in the discussions?
Well, it wasn't exactly like that, but it parallels it. And I'll tell you the version that I think is similar. There's two journeys going on in that movie. There's Jake Sully's individual exploration of his identity, where he's literally put into another state, that he ends up actually abandoning his human state in favor of. But there's also Sigourney Weaver's character, Grace, who's a scientist. So if you take a look at the things that she is exploring with her scientific technological instruments, she, or even when you see the process of Jake becoming able to transfer into his avatar state, it looks like graphs that look very much like the bioluminescence. And we did that on purpose so that what we're trying to do is convey that there were two parallel paths going on. One was scientific and one was, in a sense, more spiritual or character-driven in the sense that if you think about it, Jake Sully he's a cripple in real life. And he ends up becoming a leader. The first thing he does is run around when he's in his avatar state. But he has to develop into that leader. Grace has been developing from her science base some of the same observations about nature. And in a way, that's the way we can look at things. It's not quite where you went, which is to say we then can, in our own way, create that imagery and are attracted to creating that imagery. You know, the let there light be light, even in darkness, is obviously a very fundamentally powerful image for us to want to create.
And then now Disney, you know, making the Avatar Park in Animal Kingdom, you know, to see your work realized in a physical way that now people can actually walk through. I mean, what does that feel like?
Well, it's quite amazing. I've had that experience, never quite to the extent that world is, of course. But to have a notion of something that I'm involved in with the directors and the producers and all of the incredible number of people who work on these movies, and see them then realized as places that people can go visit on their own, you know, whether it's Back to the Future or the War of the Worlds settings at Universal or the Star Wars parks, you know, at Disneyland, or as you say, the Avatar Park. One of the things that it makes me think, and this has been over the years, I've sort of developed this idea about moviescapes, that you can go to some of these worlds, even if it's not the physical manifestation as a ride, and Jurassic Park is one of those as well, of course. But if you think about it, you can go into the worlds of the movies and not have the same narrative, nor have the same characters. And that is, I think, something that's relatively new. It's certainly been there always. I mean, going into Oz without Dorothy and a different narrative is possible in people's minds. But I think it's now being taken into the real world through this other form of entertainment and amusement parks. That's very interesting to me because it is a breakdown of sorts under this sort of guise of what is the world. And I call it a moviescape because it's like, great, it's a movie escape that you go into in the movies, but then you want more of it. And that's why there could be sequels. They're not always as good, but they're an attempt to take you back, you know, into that place that you wanted to go to again because you got something out the first time. And again, that's very much in sync with the journey motif. When you have an experience of a journey that matters, where you're not just a tourist, you're a traveler. What you're looking for happen is some form of an epiphany as to why you took the journey to begin with, that leads to a form of a catharsis. And the catharsis then makes you feel like you're purposeful and your life is in sync with your life and times and your interior desire to have meaning. And all that sounds very, you know, almost existentially highfalutin. But I'm certainly of a generation that's been doing this for a long time in seeking a kind of transcendent experience. You know, for me, it probably started with the Beatles and John Lennon and his music in particular that inspired my whole first journey to the East when I went to India in 1970. Mm. And it was to find a different way of thinking, a different paradigm shift. And that, I think, is reflected in almost every single movie that I've worked on. And that I feel very, very good about, because again, I'm not directing those stories. Those stories have come to me to help be a guide on and to help realize the vision that directors have. But of course, I've had experiences with such amazing directors, so that they always make whatever I do better. And so I'm not one of those people who says, oh, I wish I could have done this or that. I don't have that experience even once in any of the movies. Some of the movies are more successful than others, but they're all born out of a legitimate sense of, I suppose, this an authentic quest to provide vision to stories that I think are worthy and that maybe communicate out into the world certain values.
Do you have a preference for the style of film that you're doing and the style of production design that you're doing? Do you like something more grounded in reality, you know, with like, you know, Castaway and Lincoln and Forrest Gump? Or do you kind of like things where you've completely create the world? Like we were talking about Avatar and AI and things like that. I mean, you've done so much of it. I'm curious if you have a preference.
I think I've always tried to emulate what it would be like to be George Martin with the Beatles. And that is to say, to be around such genius talent that wherever it takes you, it's always fresh and new, and you apply the same basic level of curiosity and inquisitiveness and inventiveness, but that where it takes you can be very eclectic. And sometimes it can be very reality-based, and then sometimes it's absolutely fanciful. But I'm not sure that I always know the difference. That's a weird thing to say. But because I don't apply different standards, it's all an illusion to some degree. And then some illusions other people know more about going in. So you have to hit points of reference that they will believe take them into a time period or to a place. And I enjoy that kind of research, and I enjoy that type of recreation. But being able to do both, and some movies that are sort of a hybrid, which has been a lot of that too, or twisting the reality, such as in the Back to the Future movies, I find that to be very invigorating, that I've been able to have it so mixed up from movie to movie and back to back. Sometimes they parallel, and that the movies I can make associations from one to another, such as AI being about a little boy going into the ice to find himself. And then the next movie was the Polar Express.
Yeah.
And it was kind of the same movie by these two directors who I knew very well. And they were kind of like having Steven Spielberg as an older brother and Bob Zemeckis as a younger brother, who had a desire to go back and rediscover some of the basic emotions of their childhoods and wanting to be able to believe. For Steven, it was going through Stanley Kubrick's desire to do that and to tell a story about the nature of what it is to be loved and to feel that you are an authentic, real human being or boy. And then the same thing is very close in the Polar Express, where Bob Zemeckis was, after Castaway, in a sense, reinvigorating his life by looking back and rediscovering his faith. And his faith was in cinema, in the digital form, that it was a new area for him to explore. But he used the metaphor of Christmas to be able to discover, you know, in a sense, a literal ticket to ride that was a cinematic trip. And both of those are very extensive journey movies, of course. And I think it was interesting that they both did those sort of back to back. And then I got to have a double kind of experience of that in the middle of my life. I mean, I was just around 50 years old on either side when I experienced that. And I think that's not unusual for people when they turn 50 to start to reflect back to their childhoods to see where they came from.
This message is for all of you Final Cut Pro 10 users. I've got huge news and a huge offer for you from PostLab. Now, PostLab is a collaboration tool for Final Cut Pro 10, and it enables users to share libraries, track and save your changes, and it makes sure that no more than one person is working on the library simultaneously. So that means zero conflicts, plus a recallable history of your project. Now, PostLab is a cloud service, but it's also a desktop app. And what I mean by that is this. PostLab allows you to work off a local copy. So it's just like when you're working without PostLab. You don't need to change your workflow, right? Because there's always a full local copy of your library right there. Now, if for some reason your library is not on your computer, that's fine, because PostLab will download it first. It wants you to be working locally. So even though it's a cloud service, you're not working from the cloud, so it's preventing any sort of speed issues you may run into. They're all gone. And also, PostLab runs on its own cloud purposely built for libraries. Purposely built. Now, if you've used Final Cut Pro 10 and you've shared libraries across other sort of run-of-the-mill cloud services, you know that it doesn't really work that well. That's not the case with PostLab. PostLab is bulletproof, and it is exactly what you need. Aside from all of that, they have incredible collaboration. So within a library, within a production, collaborators can set up and assign tasks. You can comment on changes and set statuses for your library. There is so much there to explore, and I know you guys are going to love it. It's a must-have tool. Now, here's the great news. You're going to get 3 months free simply by going to gocreativeshow.com/postlab. 3 free months. Absolutely, this is a no-brainer. If you're using Final Cut Pro 10, you have to be using PostLab. They're going to give you 3 months free just for being Go Creative Show listeners. How about that? gocreativeshow.com/postlab. I want to talk about Star Wars a little bit. You've worked on episode 7 and episode 9. I'd love to know kind of what it's like to, you know, thinking about back to episode 7. This is it's not necessarily a reboot, but you're once again bringing Star Wars back into the zeitgeist, bringing it back to, you know, a younger generation. So you're in effect sort of recreating how the younger and next generation is going to have a first Star Wars movie experience. What does that feel like? And what sort of pressures does that put on you?
Because I was, I was 27 when Star Wars came out in 1977. I had already been around the world twice. And then, so I wasn't seeing it like J.J. Abrams as an 11-year-old. And so what was interesting for me was I felt like I was one of the elders because I was actually already older than Alec Guinness was when he played Obi-Wan Kenobi. Mm. So I looked at the whole process as very much a transition from one generation to another, trying to express what we had discovered, but also so that you could move it forward into the future. And ironically, if you just hear what I just said, it's like going back to the future, meaning I went back in order to go forward. And so that is a motif that, of course, actually Bob had been influenced by the original Star Wars movies to experience, because remember, it started with number 4. So what happened to 1, 2, and 3? You know, the whole thing became out of time.
Yeah.
Right. And then that's, of course, the basis of the Back to the Future trilogy. So for me, that was part of what I was trying to convey. And in a sense, I was trying to ask that fundamental question, not about the Force as something separate only about Star Wars, but what is, number one, the Force? And Steven Spielberg would say, and has said to me, that he feels that the Force is intuition. That how intuition plays a role in his life, he would regard as the Force. And if you think about it, that kind of a put aside the things that are telling you what it's supposed to be, but see what it is, that was what I was trying to help people who are younger come in and experience for the first time and then take on a responsibility to confront the darkness if it should arise again, as it did. And that you would find that much of the darkness is not just out there, but it is in your own heart. And to be able to make a transformation to actually confront the darkness that's within you as well, so that you can find a way from the inside to deal with it, as Luke had to, and as Rey had to, and as Ben Solo did, as Kylo Ren. I thought those were worthy themes given any time, really, but particularly our times now. And it was great to be there in the beginning for the first one. I then had a number of consultations with Rian Johnson before he made his movie. And I know how personal that imagery is to him, just as I know how personal the imagery is for JJ. And I can convey some of that. But one thing I would like to say, just by bringing up both JJ and Rian, is that that was part of the whole message, was come in to this world that Kathy Kennedy and Disney were creating for directors and storytellers to tell a version of the story that's personal to you, because it was very personal to George, the way he created that world and all those stories. So Rian, of course, took the story that JJ had laid out to a different place and in a different direction. But if you think about it, he created a masterful second act. First of all, he got a tremendous number of people to reevaluate some of the givens that they thought that they knew. Some people didn't like that, but a lot of people were very invigorated, particularly critics. So what did he do? He took the thing that supposedly mattered so much, the Excalibur symbol, the lightsaber. And the first thing that Luke did was take it and sort of seemingly throw it away, right? What he was trying to do, like a Zen monk would do back in the day, or still, is to say your preconceptions that you're walking into this with need to be put aside so you can see what really is important. And he was not even sure, Luke wasn't himself, what was actually important. She was part of the catalyst for him determining what was important. But if you realize by the end of the movie how powerful that lightsaber has become, then that's because Rian was able to strip it all down and then bring it back. So you had a few things to work with. That was one of them, the lightsaber. But he had taken away many of the other things that you would want to assume that you would always have. Now, of course, it went further than that in real life, because Carrie Fisher passed away, and that was devastating to how could she now be in the next movie if she wasn't here. And then JJ made it very, very clear that it was important to him that she be an anchor for that final movie, because it was her journey, if you think about it, from the very beginning, that has been the really long journey that has gone through so much. If you think about the heroine's journey, it's one thing to think about Rey and the first 30 years of her life, but what Leia has gone through, from being a princess and a lover and a general and a mother and losing her son, and then taking on this other woman, a young girl who doesn't know who she is and trying to guide her, and then reaching out at the end to stop her son from dying in that way and being healed by the woman so that she can pass as Obi-Wan Kenobi did and have had a fulfilled life. That kind of thing was there in the beginning for JJ, it was there for Rian, and it was there at the end, even after Carrie Fisher had passed away, and yet there she was in the movie. And that was very personal for JJ and Rian. Both of them have very, very strong relationships with their mothers, and are honoring those relationships in the movies that you see. Obviously, Stanley Kubrick and Steven Spielberg had the same. That's in AI and in full display. The love of a mother, the woman's not just young journey, which is nothing wrong with that. That's why you want to convey that to a younger audience. Sure. So you could start on a journey. But if you get to be older and you're looking at your life, some of these more rich experiences that are very hard to go through at times, but those provide for a real lifetime. And I think that's all in the Star Wars movies that are there, all three of them. And I think that the fact that at the end of number 8, you're left with a situation where supposedly Rey's confronted what Rian said was her worst situation of being nobody. Well, JJ said to himself, that's not as bad as it can get. As bad as that is for a second act, what if she has to confront that the darkness is in her and that she's connected to it and has to find a different path forward? I thought that was entirely on a journey in the big scope of those three movies, a wonderful progression. And I'm sorry that people feel like they need to take one or the other side. And I'm hoping over time that what people see is it is quite a coherent and I think invigorating journey. I think JJ, if he had done all three, would not have probably gone as far in the second act to creating a situation where, you know, the call went out, nobody answered. There's 14 people in Millennium Falcon. Rey is nobody. Luke is gone. And now, you know, what are we going to do? You know, if you think about what would you do to make a Star Wars number 9 after that, it was a daunting task, but it was a good task. It was the right task. People, yes, they didn't know all the answers, but they knew a lot. And they knew what they wanted it to feel like. And Kathy Kennedy was very, very good, as was Michelle Rejwan, the other producer, in guiding this towards what it became, which I think is a trilogy that fits within the other 9 as one big story. And as somebody from my age, I can say that I very much related to what was being told.
I want to talk for a few minutes about creating planets for Rise of Skywalker. And we have an audience question, NickField90 on Twitter. He wants to know if you can walk us through your experience creating Palpatine's lair on Exegol.
That's interesting, obviously, because how Palpatine's lair on Exegol came into creation took quite a while. We knew that we wanted to have him be in a state that was one that you could kind of believe he'd been through something, because obviously last time we saw him, he was thrown down that long shaft and we presumed he was dead. So he was brought back in a form that was not quite fully human, because he was so augmented with all these other technological kind of apparatuses. But what was more important to me was that it's a mirror image of sorts of the two old temples, one being on Skellig Island where Luke is, which is a real place in off the coast of Ireland, and that's where he went as a retreat, where the Jedi Order would have first come into being and be the place as it really is in real life as a Christian monastery of 500 BC, AD. Exegol was, for me, and the place that we went to take our inspiration from was actually Petra in Jordan, which is something that is ancient to a place, as a place where the emperor, in whatever form he was, would have been returned there to reconstitute his abilities and his ability specifically, of course, to project into the world through Snoke and all the various ways that he's been doing it over the years. But that comes from an ancient place. And so that's why what you see is this overscale kind of Sith temple that is a lightning planet, because that's, you know, something we associate deeply with the Emperor, is his ability to use the Force with the lightning. And so there was also an idea that JJ wanted to have the confrontation between Palpatine and Rey be in front of an audience of his followers, because if he was going to be offering her that throne, then, and she accepted it, then that would mean, by striking him down, then that would mean that all those people were now in on that. It's like a Nuremberg rally on a spiritual level, that she would be consumed by the Sith darkness. And so that's what led to the idea that there was a place where everybody was congregated and you could still open up and see up into the heavens, where you could see the battle that was going on above, with the Star Destroyers and all of the fleet that had arrived. But what was also interesting to me was that Rey from there had access through all of that to go all the way up. And what you end up doing when she's looking up there is going past all the mayhem and going just to the very essence. It's the first image you ever see in Star Wars, is that star field. And she goes back to that in order to get the messages from all the Jedi who've ever come before to empower her to take this battle one last level to Palpatine. And rather than being actually where she's bringing her own power to strike him down, which is what he was asking for, she's actually using all of that as a resistance to his power that literally bounces it back onto him. So he's actually destroyed by his own negativity, just reflected back onto him, which ends up imploding and destroying him, all of his followers, and all of the temple. But it was a lot of trying to come up with simple shapes. Kevin Jenkins, the co-designer, did just infinite numbers of sketches that were wonderful to try to get at this. We had a number of artists work on this. And finally, it became a relatively simple sort of temple with that, you know, elevated design that JJ actually, I think, came up with. And then down underneath into the layer being something that I think it just invoked an ancient place that the Sith had originated and gotten their power from. And we went to Petra in Jordan as inspiration for that.
There is still so much to get to with Rick Carter. But before we get there, I want to talk about Rule Boston Camera. Now, Rule is the place to go to purchase and rent all of your production equipment for a couple of reasons. One, they have a world-class inventory of rental gear accumulated over the 35 years that they've been in business. We're talking cameras, audio, lighting, grip gear, communication, camera dynamics. Everything you want is there. In fact, when big giant Hollywood films come into town, which they do often, they use Rule, right? There, that just goes to show you right there. So you have an incredible inventory. But then on top of that, they have the best service in the business. They understand that production is mission critical. They understand that you need a partner in your production. So they're going to make sure that you have expert advice and counsel in pre-production. You're going to get technical guidance when you take the equipment out for your shoot, and they are committed to support you the whole time you have their equipment. So we're talking about peace of mind, right? Every minute is valuable in production. These are expensive days, people, right? Rule Boston Camera is your production partner. That's why we love them. So check them out for yourself and experience the Rule way at rule.com, R-U-L-E.com. When you first start a project and, you know, as production designer, you're involved intimately very early on. I mean, we've talked to cinematographers that tell us that, you know, by the time they're involved, there could be years of development that the production designer is involved in. And I don't think a lot of people necessarily know that. But that aside, when you begin a project, what is the first role that you fill on your team? Who's the next person you engage with to get the ball rolling?
Usually some form of an illustrator or illustrators, a group of illustrators, sometimes art directors and location scouts to go out if we need to know how to anchor the movie right away. That's why it depends how fantastic the imagery is. You need much more illustration if you're going to create a world from scratch than if you're going to go look for it and then actually adapt it for the movie.
Yeah.
So one of the interesting things about production design is I have no by the numbers process, because especially the way it's gone with all the international travel, I just get dropped into a place. I have to pull together a team often of people that I don't know.
Oh.
And so I don't come with my group into a situation. I might know some people, but more and more, very few that I've ever worked with before. So my first job is to locate people that I think I can relate to, will be on the wavelength, have an enthusiasm and an inspiration, and of course, you know, the chops to pull it off. But basically the idea is it's like coming to a place, again, on that journey level, who am I actually encountering? Who can I work with? And the collaborative process is so important to me. I'm not a one-man band. I'm somebody who needs not only the genius of the directors, but I also need close to genius from all the people that I get to hire and work with, from illustrators and set decorators and art directors, of course, the visual effects gurus that I don't hire, but I get to work with, and I've done that with some of the best people ever.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like the strength of production design is in the understanding of how collaborative the process has to be, and when there's nothing there, how much you have to create with a team that puts it in front of everybody else so that they have what Bob Zemeckis would call their marching orders. They can see it. They know what the plan is. You've helped to design the production, not just on the visual side, but where it's going to be shot, how it's going to be shot. And then you fill it in with things that the director thinks is going to be a great setting and has good ideas behind it. And then everybody else can then amplify that. But when that's not there, when there's nothing there and it's a blank canvas, there's a lot of ways of looking at a blank canvas. You can look at it as nothing, or you can look at it as everything, meaning like white light that has all the colors. And Bob Zemeckis used to talk about having a whiteout when he got the sort of flash of what the whole movie would be. Mm. And then he had to discern it from that and pull it into reality by examining all the parts. But one of the aspects of production design is there's often so little going on. Not again, the writers are paramount, and the producers for getting it all together and giving you the basis, and usually a great script if you're fortunate.
Yeah, how do you mean so little going on? In what way?
Well, because as on Star Wars or on, I'll say, the Polar Express, where there was the book, but that's all there was, or in Jurassic Park, when we're trying to take those types of images that are in the book, but we don't know how we can possibly do it, and the computer-generated dinosaurs have never been done before, and no one's even thought of it when I was starting. So we're trying to figure out there's a story and there's an idea, but that the visual component is helping to determine what the story becomes.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to take anything away from anybody else that they can contribute. It's about orchestrating all of that so that when the crew can come on, then they know what the foundation is, then they can do their job. And a cinematographer, I've always thought, is, for me, other than the director, is the person I have to absolutely relate to, because whatever we're going to come up with, they have to be able to, like, if I'm imagining things that don't exist, they're imagining those things now existing, but in such a way that they can shoot them and the graphic image and the lighting can all work, and that there's a visual philosophy behind it that is true to what they can do, want to do, and it's in sync with the director. So that's a huge collaboration.
Yeah, I can only imagine that your ideas kind of start big and then get refined over, you know, it gets more and more refined as you incorporate new departments like cinematography, wardrobe, all that kind of stuff.
Well, they're big. They get bigger, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because reality, rather than, a lot of people say reality imposes a tyranny that makes you compromise, and that many directors will tell you that's how they feel compared to what's in their head, and writers, what they've imagined, and then what is on the screen at the end. That's not my experience. My experience is that I start with something that's hopefully strong enough that inspires people and invokes other people's levels of inspiration to come to it. And then it becomes bigger than the sum of its parts, if you're lucky, at the end. And you just look at it and you wonder how it got created, because it's certainly from my vantage point, it's not mine by the time it's out there in the movie.
Yeah.
It's something I've contributed to, but it's the process that I find to be not just invigorating, but essential to making movies more than they would be. There's a funny story with Jim Cameron, who is so talented, as all these guys are. But I mean, he can draw, he can do He can write. He's a great editor. He's a great cameraman. He's been an art director for Roger Corman. So one time he was trying to convey something, and he just sort of said something like, "God, you know, I can do everybody's job here better than they can." And I laughed and I said, "Yeah, but why do you think there's so much for everybody here to do?" And he kind of looked at me like, "Well, what? And what are you saying?" And I'm saying, and I explained this, that you could be in your basement trying to make one movie for your entire lifetime. It would never be as good as any of these. So you have to, because of the expansiveness of his vision, involve a lot of people and learn to work through many, many people. And that's kind of something I've felt that all the directors that I've worked with have been very, very good at, is that they're not territorial. Even, I mean, Jim Cameron is, he's always open to a better idea. It's just he's got very many good ideas. So does Steven Spielberg. So does Bob Zemeckis. So does Zack Snyder. So does J.J. Abrams. These people are major brain powers when it comes to cinema. But they also know how important it is to have other people around them contribute so that it becomes bigger than just what they would do. And also then that means that the next step that they get to take off from is that much further along. So for instance, in the collaborative process, in the best ways, and again, that goes back to John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, Ringo Starr, if you imagine them always making it better, Bob Zemeckis, when I would talk with him sometimes in the beginning and do a kind of visual reconnoiter of some idea that I might have for something, and throw it out to him, whether it's through an image or through a sentence or whatever I'm saying. Over and over again, his eyes would bug out and he would say things like, "Well, what I thought you were going to say is," and then he would come up with a whole sequence based upon what we were talking about.
Wow.
That would go right in the movie as is. And I would say to him, "Now, were you thinking about that before I started talking?" He said, no, that just all sort of came as you were talking, but he's using my energy to go somewhere else that is inspired by that level, but then it's all can be the one that he's thinking about. So the transference there is making it something that the energy level of the conversation and the inspiration becomes almost as important as the specifics. Obviously, you have to get to the specifics, but these guys are so good at coming up with specifics. It's about hitting the right level. So for me, that kind of freed me from feeling like I had to be right. I just had to come up with things that I believed in, that I cared about, that would stimulate the conversation. And with, Jim Cameron, he would say, "I don't know what you just said, but I like that we're getting so much done." So, and then Steven Spielberg would say things like, "I hear what you're saying. Now say that again." And I'd say something and then have a slightly different take on it, whatever it was, trying to get it closer into a zone where I thought he would get it. And then he would go, "Hmm." And then as he'd say like, "Hmm," I'd say, "Well, I think you're about to have a great idea." And he'd say, "What do you mean?" And I go, I'd say something. And then he would say something in return. And I'd say, "See?" And it was a great idea. So I was kind of playing with him because I wasn't trying to be right. I was just trying to guide and be a part of that interaction with him that took it to somewhere that then a great idea comes out. And that's, for me, that's what production designing is. It's setting the stage for, and then it's not just a scene, it's dot, 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 the whole movie, a specific, just being a part of that which gets the movie into a collaborative level that people make it better and better. And there's so many talented people now that you can work with. It's just, can you guide them and keep them all working in the same, direction? And I know I'm speaking more generally than I am specifically, but that's because I've been doing this for 45 years, and lots of people can tell you about lots of specific things that they do as a production designer. And I can do that. I can say that in Munich, we put the color red before every murder, so it's a part of the scene and it's in the, and those are aesthetic choices that I'm playing out and enjoying doing with the costume designer or whoever. But for me, what really interests me are these bigger levels of contribution to the filmmaking process.
I can tell. I mean, I we've had production designers on in the past, and we've gotten really nitty gritty on color choices, fabric choices, things like that. And to be honest with you, I thought that our conversation could go down that road because it's been like that with other production designers. But I like where you're taking it. I mean, you're keeping it. You're speaking from a perspective of someone who's just worked on so many projects that are just massive. I mean, your portfolio is. I mean, everyone is envious of this portfolio, let's be honest. So it's interesting to hear where you kind of land on your thoughts on your entire career and how you approach, you know, films like you worked on Star Wars and Wicked. But just, I heard you in an interview say something that I thought was really interesting, and I wanted you to elaborate on it here on the show. You'd said, it's very important not to know what you're doing. And I thought that was really interesting. I'd love to know, first of all, do you even remember saying that, or was it just this piece of genius that fell out? What does that mean? It seems almost, it seems like the complete opposite of what I would think a production designer would say, because I feel like the production designer steers the ship in a way that the director does, you know?
Yes, I do remember saying that, and it's reminding me of George Harrison in the anthology of the Beatles. And he said this line, he said, you know, really all you need is love and I'm sticking to it. Mm-hmm. And what I'm saying here is that you adapt yourself to the situation that you're in. But to not know is to open yourself up to a possibility of discovering something that nobody else has ever done before. Bob Zemeckis would always say, if somebody would refer to another movie the way something was done, and he would say, if we're going to do it just like that, then anybody can do it. Because once that's out there in the world, anybody can copy it. I think that the idea of not knowing, obviously, if you don't know how to do anything or very much, that can be a dangerous situation.
Of course, yeah.
You know, I mean, a cinematographer not knowing how the camera works is not a good situation.
Well, you've given a lot of hope to people that don't know what they're doing in this episode.
I think that what I'm, and to all of you out there, don't try this at home. I think what I'm trying to say is I've always tried to identify where I really am. And I always have so many questions. And I know specifically Steven Spielberg, and we've had many conversations about this, he's always afraid of the movies that he takes on. And he's said to me, I don't think I could do a movie that I wasn't afraid of because it wouldn't get his blood going the same way. Mm. And he looks for that kind of jolt to his system. So he can't just finesse the situation as he did the last time. And it just becomes your shtick over time. I think that the aspect of that I was trying to convey, of course, it's a little bit like, you know, a Zen koan kind of thing that those Eastern religion people would say, something doesn't seem to make sense, but maybe it does. What I was trying to get at is that each time I find that I've got so many questions and actual, I wouldn't call them fears, but I know I have to discover a process. So when I get to that level that I know I don't know, then I can relax a little bit because I'm in that blank canvas, but usually something comes out of it. And particularly since I've worked with such talented directors, they usually will say something that I can latch onto. And even for instance, you know, let's say with J.J. Abrams, who is, you know, I think he's 17 years younger than I am. We went to the same high school. We had the same English teacher and 17 years apart, who taught, in a sense, existentialism and authenticity and what it was to actually try to live a life that was true to yourself. And when it came into the process of creating a character for number 7, The Force Awakens, who would embody the kind of knowledge that Yoda would have, but in a new generation, we both thought of Mrs. Gilbert, our teacher, who was 94 at the time, as an example of somebody who had impacted both of us in this teaching guide way. And so actually Maz Kanata is actually designed based on Mrs. Rose Gilbert, our high school teacher.
Really?
And it was fascinating that we could both go to that place, because she was very strong for both of us at basically identifying where we didn't know things, but making it okay to not know it. And I think that kind of process that JJ has, that Jim Cameron has, Bob Zemeckis, Steven Spielberg, Zack Snyder, they don't know. And if you can identify what is not known, then there's a way for that to move forward. And then you eventually, you know it, but that becomes part of the journey of what you didn't know that at the end of the movie, you have some understanding of. But to identify early that you don't necessarily know exactly what you're doing or how you're going to do it. I don't know of any movie, but most of the movies that I talk with people about, they don't know how they're going to do it. I'm very good friends with Dennis Gastner, who we're kind of two people of the same generation who have these parallel careers. We, you know, I was around when he was doing 1917, and you know how they were going to do that. It sounds like it's technical, and it is, but it's also very daunting on just a level of what is it you're trying to accomplish, and then to work that through the process of filmmaking. I find that to be the single thing that's the most exciting is to I don't know how to put it.
Have you ever had in your experience a film that kind of scared you at first, where you thought, "Geez, I really don't know if this is possible." I mean,
all of them,
really.
I mean, honestly, I could take you through the litany. I had no idea how we would do Back to the Future 2 and 3 back to back, and then do it like a hat trick in that town square of showing you at 1955, 1985 as an alternate, and 2015,
yeah.
But all within one production, plus another version that was going to have a Western town built from scratch somewhere else and a drive-in out in Mountain and Valley. That's just the physical side. But every single movie, for the budgets, the Avatar, Jurassic Park, Forrest Gump, Munich, because of the location issues and the budget issues. I don't really know how to do it, other than to forward into the process and to convey as little fear as possible.
Yeah.
You know, but I do acknowledge it so that people who are around me don't feel like they have to be uptight and know too much. And then I count on them coming through. And because they maybe, like I, have a sense of authorship for the movie itself, if that makes sense. Meaning that they, in their disciplines, feel like they are really contributing and learning something along the way.
Where did you start before production design? Did you start as an art director or camera operator or anything like that?
Well, I started, just take a step back from being a traveler, I've always painted and drawn people. So I've got a far-sighted eye that, and a near-sighted eye. The far-sighted eye is more like the movie work that's out there, backgrounds and worlds. The right eye is for portraits of people. So I was always a painter, drawing, and when I was traveling.
So hold on, wait. So you're saying literally you have one?
Yeah.
So okay. So that's it. All right. I thought you were just kind of talking in just general terms about your sensibilities and the way you approach things. But you actually have one eye that's nearsighted, one eye that's farsighted.
Right.
So when you talk about like the one eye that's for painting and drawing, like, are you, what do you mean? Are you like covering one? Are you covering one?
Well,
or are you, what are you doing?
Inside my head.
Yeah.
What happens is I only look with one eye at a time. And I actually can't see 3D in a movie.
Wow.
So imagine talking with Jim Cameron about the 3D in Avatar, and I don't actually see the third dimension the way they're seeing it.
Oh my God.
Because I don't have two points of view on it. However, because that poses a problem, see, most of the situations I've gotten into are to take a deficit and turn it into a positive. And that's what I've tried to do. So with that one in particular, what I realized was I needed to take this deficit And I actually associated it with Jake Sully's being a cripple. And I needed to be able to go on a journey in my mind's eye that would allow me to succeed the way he succeeds in the movie, to become not only a leader, but to succeed in the battle with the forces that he thought were conscientiously opposed to what he thought was right. So what I did was I realized that my version of the avatar state that Jake has in the movie is the metaphor for me, meaning I'm a cripple, I can't see 3D, but I'm going to make it so that I have a 3D vision about this movie that is in sync with what it is to go into that MRI type machine and be transferred into another dimension and be able to production design and work with Jim in that whole arena along with Robert Stromberg to actually make it better than it would have been otherwise, because I'll contribute on a metaphoric level to the 3D of the movie. And to give you an example of that is it's to recognize and be able to say early on to everybody, this is a hybrid movie, obviously, but think about it. It's a hybrid movie on a technical level because it's live action and it's digital.
Yeah.
But it's also a hybrid movie on the content level because it's about a human who goes into another state, a digital state in another dimension, and then actually ends up, in fact, identifying so much with that other state that he decides to relinquish his human state to move on. So that was a kind of, as esoteric as that sounds, that was a real process for me in order to contribute to the movie on a 3D level when I couldn't actually see, per se, the depth that they were talking about that was coming off the screen. But I did understand, for instance, that the first 3D shot that we did, which was that came back, which was where Neytiri has her bow pointed and an arrow pointed on Jake Sully, and she's going to kill him. And when she first sees him, and then she sees something that comes out from the side of the frame and it lands, it's that wood sprite on the end of her bow, which is a very big 3D moment. And it changes her point of view about him. That means the technical shot of showing 3D in that movie and the first one that we were looking at with those eyes conveyed the whole message of the movie, because it's basically there's Ewa entering the movie. And then by the end, she says, Ewa has heard you, and all that stuff happens in the sky and everything that wins the battle. So the 3D of the movie is an expansive experience for the audience, not just on the technical level, but on the emotional content of the movie, the story, what happens. And to identify that as a production designer and lay that out so people could tap into that and understand how at least I saw that, and then Jim agreed, then that became things that people could work with. It sounds like, what the hell? I know to people who think, well, I thought you're just supposed to, you know, pick the color over here and pick a location here and design a cool prop and maybe an interesting architecture. But I found that the creation of the place of a movie is all the specifics within it, but it's also the overall that you feel by being in it, because there are actual ideas in there, and it's a visual philosophy that's being conveyed by the movie. And I get to partake in that.
In our last couple of minutes, I want to talk about these books that you create for each of you. I don't know if it's for every movie or many of your movies, but I saw in a previous interview you've done, you're sort of flipping through these books that are collections of stills from the film, and then also some of the inspiration pieces. Can you talk to us a little bit about that and when that started for you?
Well, once the digital revolution in publishing came, meaning that you could download images and then upload images to create books, I found that it was a way for me to create, in a sense, notebooks going along that I didn't try to make them perfect or anything, and they're not even really publishable, but they are a record of my experience, both as an artist, my paintings I do the same thing with, and my what I call the moviescape experiences. And I put together a book now that actually has all the experiences as best as I can put them together. But I'm not probably the writer that I'd like to be in order to be able to really convey all these levels. But I do try to do it anyway because it's a record, and it's something that then you put on your bookshelf and feel like there's a kind of document that captures at least how I thought at the time. And when I go back to it, I usually get something from that, a sense of the overall and where I was at any given moment.
And what's included in this book or these books?
Well, I, you know, let's say the there's one says this Oscar sees you. That was for my Avatar experience, because that's what I said when I got an Oscar with Robert Stromberg and Kim Sinclair. But what I was saying was to Jim Cameron, because I thought, well, if I'm going to be able to get up there, what am I going to say? And I don't want to say a lot, but I want to make sure he's acknowledged, because he was the primary visualist and visionary of the movie. And so I just turned the Oscar towards him. I said, this Oscar sees you. I wanted to acknowledge that. And so all the emails that we sent back and forth and the way the movie was designed, I just put it together in my own personal sort of scrapbook. But I wanted to make it about the emotion that I had at the time, which was being able to work with him and to create that world and that whole movie. And I've just done that with Steven Spielberg and Bob Zemeckis, and then I try to combine them at times. And you know, some of them are stills from the internet, other things are stills that I've done myself or collected, and they're like scrapbooks, really, that hopefully convey something. And I have an archive at USC, and so I hope that, you know, years from now, if someone wants to go back and look at how these things were put together, not just for my books, but I save a lot of the drawings and videos and files, so that maybe if there is interest, you know, I don't know, 20 years, 30 years from now, someone can begin to see what it was like. Because I think when movies are out and they're in the public, everybody thinks, oh, look, they're so like together. And they are, but there's a point at which they're not. And then they have to iteratively, step by step, be created. And that's what I'm trying to convey, both to myself, but also, you know, maybe some people in the future will be interested.
Maybe. I mean, I can imagine there's interest at this very moment. I mean, it's fascinating to, it would be fascinating to just kind of see that and see it's a look into your mind in a little, you know, visual journal to the entire production of a film. Like, that's incredible.
Well, it's pretty overwhelming to me. I think most people would just kind of look at it and go, what the hell? I mean, it's a lot. And I try to leave enough that's a guide through it, so people can, you know, have an understanding. Maybe just this podcast will have some illumination that somebody will catch, and then, if nothing more, be inspired to understand that movies are a collaborative medium, that a lot of people play a role in there, and a lot of very thoughtful people who really care about the work that they're doing and feel a sense of artistic authorship, not to the exclusion of anybody else, but in collaboration. And I've gotten to work, you know, in a sense, I've gotten to work with the Beatles, right? I mean, you know, Steven Spielberg, Bob Zemeckis, Jim Cameron, and J.J. Abrams is, you know, that's pretty good. And then, you know,
Zack
Snyder in there,
exactly.
As a fifth Beatle. And, you know, I think there's something about getting to a certain age, I'm almost 70, where I can look back and I can see the body of work, I can see my life and how those two are intertwined. And the best I've been able to do is to identify the journey that it's been, that was there from the beginning and still is going forward. And Star Wars in particular is kind of I don't know what's after this, because if you think about it, that one's a pretty big finale that actually goes all the way back to 1977, which is around the time when I was beginning on Hal Ashby movies. So it pretty much encompasses this period, and to want to pass it on and yet honor the past.
What's next for you?
I don't know. I did a little bit of work on Wicked, and I've handed that to Sarah Greenwood, who is just doing an amazing job making that into a movie that I think a couple of years from now will be just a fantastic movie with Stephen Daldy directing. And I've worked on the Academy Museum in Los Angeles, helping with some of the exhibitions. And I'm not really sure what movie is going to be next. We'll see. We'll see what Stephen or Bob or whoever, maybe that's new, I get to work with.
I love that. No sign of slowing down. And wow, I mean, do you have a portfolio of films here that would just, it's just incredible. It's absolutely stunning. Your work is great and you're worthy of all your success. So thank you for being on Go Creative Show and sharing your experiences.
Thank you very much.
Wow, what an honor to have Rick Carter on the show, legendary production designer. We're so happy to have him here, right? I mean, it's amazing. When you think about what this guy has worked on in his career, it is just mind-blowing. And I'm always so humbled and thankful when, you know, people like that at his level come on here and talk about their stuff right here on the Go Creative Show. It's just so fun to have, you know, to have those types of experiences shared on the show. I hope you guys like it. So please let us know what you think by going to Go Creative Show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram and giving us some feedback. Let us know what you think. And if you have any guest suggestions, we'd love to hear that too. I also want to thank our producer, Connor Crosby, who puts this show together and does a ton of behind-the-scenes work to make it all happen. You can follow him at ignitionvisuals.com, ignitionvisuals.com. And of course, Matt Russell for mixing, mastering, and making the show sound so good. Find him at gainstructure.com, at gainstructure. And of course, you should be following me too, because my Instagram is filled with behind-the-scenes stories and photos from shoots that I'm on. This week alone, I did a shoot for a two-day shoot for Honda Dealers of New England. So we've got a ton of behind-the-scenes there in my Instagram stories. You guys are going to absolutely love it. I've been having a lot of fun doing it, and you get to see what I've been working on when I'm not doing Go Creative Show. It's all there on Instagram at Ben Consoli. All right, guys. Please remember to support our sponsors, Rule Boston Camera and Post Lab. Without them, the show won't exist. So please support those that support us. And we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.